When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1332.PR2502, certificate number 39453, B. Traven.
Hey, that's my number.
Sure enough.
Oh, just look at that fat, rich printed number. That's the kind of sugar Papa likes.
Oh, people be Traven.
I be Traven.
I miss be Traven. Have you seen The Treasure of the Sierra Madre?
No.
Are you resistant in general to kind of TCM black and white movie culture? No, right? You do a podcast about...
Yeah, in fact...
About square old movies that dads watch.
Two nights ago, I watched Duck Soup.
Oh, Duck Soup has aged super well. Plus, it's like 67 minutes.
It's so great.
All old movies should be like an hour, because then your kids like won't complain.
But then a week ago, we watched Bringing Up Baby just because we were looking for some wholesome fare for our nine-year-old daughter.
How did that play?
I think we all enjoyed it. She's now walking around talking with a mid-Atlantic accent.
I was born on the side of a hill. George!
and that's delightful, and I'm encouraging her to keep speaking in mid-Atlantic. But you also remember those movies from the 30s are from that era where funny, where like a romantic comedy is just everyone shouting all the time. Like, they're just shouting at each other because it's not that far away from the stage.
It's called Screwball.
Yeah.
And I guess that's right. They all come from George Kaufman stage plays, and then audiences would just roll in the aisles when people tripped over a carpet and yelled at the butler.
Yeah, a lot of slipping on banana peels.
A whole dinosaur falls down and bringing a baby.
That's right. A lot of people talking over each other, and then the mishearing is the joke, or somebody runs off and something bad happens because there's a lot of just a lot of slapstick is just confusion. People just sort of running around in confusion.
That's especially true in the Marx Brothers, where it's really just how many gags per minute can we get in here?
I don't think I ever truly appreciated how much Harpo is just the prototype of the Joker. Like, he just wants to watch the world burn. He's absolutely chaotic evil.
Like, he'll just see a telephone and cut the cord of it to the receiver for just, no reason.
You turn your back on him and
he just has a giant piece of, he has a giant pair of scissors in his coat.
He cuts your belt. He cuts the back off of your jacket, you know, and he has that same manic look on his face, but he never gets in trouble really. Like, he never pays the price.
Is that what you want? You want justice for Harpo?
No, but I watched Duck Soup with a new eye. I used to hate him. I used to just feel like, what is this all about? Like, I was focused on Groucho.
The Marx Brothers have the three types of funny people that there are. Smartass, stupid, and horny.
Right. Like, oh, right. And Harpo's horny.
Harpo's always chasing blondes, and they're going around the desk giggling like it's a Beetle Bailey cartoon.
But I felt like Chico really stood out to me in Duck Soup. Like, all of a sudden, I understood that Chico was really the glue that held the whole game together. Groucho's just making quips.
Groucho and Harpo are on their own planet.
Yeah.
Chico is actually, I mean, sometimes there's a fourth one advancing the plot, like there is in Duck Soup, because they hadn't got rid of Zeppo yet. But,
right.
But yes, you need Chico because...
he's the one that's...
He talks to both of them.
Right. He seems rooted in reality, at least a little.
Yeah. Yeah, I think old movies age pretty well, but I don't want to pretend that it's the same experience, like you relax into Bringing Up Baby the same way you would into Legally Blonde.
No, it's not. And I haven't seen The Treasure of the Sierra Madre for the simple reason that of the 1,000 movies that could have been on the late night movie, the 200 times I watched the late night movie, it wasn't one.
That's the big change, I think, with people any younger than us do not have the late night movie. Like, we were kind of forced to watch old movies by local TV stations that got them in syndication packages.
Yeah, you went around the three channels and you picked the least bad option.
And if it was Katharine Hepburn in a taxi cab yelling at someone,
yeah,
you watched that.
Sure, that ended up being it.
And that's totally gone now, that you can exactly choose what you want to watch. And really, just if you liked the last thing you watched, watch 10 more of those, and then it's 3 a.m., you know? So, I think that's the big reason for a generation that sometimes gets lambasted for their impatience with old movies. Like, do you remember when Shea Serrano got interviewed by Esquire and he said, like, yeah, my new movie book doesn't have any old movies? And then he was like, I mean, some old movies are good, like Star Wars or Alien, but it doesn't have any like other old, like, to him, old movies are late 70s.
Right.
And I think he said he tried to watch Rififi. Do you know this French heist movie?
Yeah.
They bust into Topkapi Palace or something. And he was just like, you know, and people always said it was a great heist movie, and no, like, you know, I've seen heist movies, and you know, you can just sit back and watch Mission Impossible 4, and this was not that, right. You know?
Well, and it's these movies are the font of so much that we take for granted in our culture. Like, watching Duck Soup, you suddenly have an appreciation for Bugs Bunny that you couldn't possibly have without having seen Duck Soup, right? I watched Bugs Bunny and thought that most of those gags were invented by Warner Brothers. But Bugs is just Groucho. And so much of that humor was originally just referencing what everybody would have known. But to me, Generation X kid, it was copped well enough that it seemed original. And that's how I know that whole sense of humor.
And I wonder if that's why, and that's probably a big challenge to people being shown old movies, is that they've seen all the sharper, more finely honed right. descendants of it, you know, in every variety. And so the Urtex is not that interesting.
It's why Close Encounters is so boring now. Yeah. But when we watched it in the theaters, you were on the edge of your seat through all those scenes where Richard Dreyfuss is just being a dope. Your stomach is still clenched because you know somewhere out there there's a spaceman that's going to come. But compare that to Independence Day. There's no comparison.
Independence Day, you see the Starman waiting in the sky, you know, 20 minutes in, and then he gets punched. So the fact that tastes advance, not just change, but advance, really does. It's an honest knock against these movies, is that, you know, it doesn't matter who dreamed up that device or structure, because you've seen sharper versions of it, like on network TV, you know? Right. I was reading this story. This is a little tangential. I'm sure you'll be shocked. I was reading this like early 20th century ghost story called The White People yesterday, because I thought it was going to be about...
Oh, sure.
I thought it was going to be about racial justice.
Sure, you're woke and...
No. I was researching the trope of the ghost who doesn't know he's a ghost. I was trying to see how far back it goes.
Oh, how far back does it go?
It turns out the most famous early examples are Lovecraft and Ambrose Bierce, who both used it for twist endings, just like movies like The Sixth Sense.
So the reader also didn't know they were a ghost
right.
until the end.
The narrator discovers he's a ghost at the end and is like, what? Like, the Lovecraft story is a pretty famous one that ends with him seeing a shambling monster and reaching out and finding out it's a mirror.
Oh, no way.
But the funny thing is you read all these now and you immediately see the twist.
Right.
Like in The White People, this young girl in the Scottish heath is always sees these anachronistic people riding out of the moor and in a little silent little waif girl who plays with her. And her whole life she sees these like strange, pale creatures. And for the whole story, it's a novella, 10 chapters. Nobody else can see them.
Uh-huh.
Everyone else seems very interested and nods concernedly when she talks about them. And then at the end of the story, we find out, guess what? They were ghosts.
They were ghosts.
All those, yeah. It's not that she's a ghost, but it's just all the pale, strange people that she saw that nobody else could see were ghosts. And that's the twist ending of this story. Hmm. And you're like, well, yeah, I guess if you've never read a ghost story, this must be a real eye popper, you know? You're gonna have to run and tell all your friends to read this.
The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, like so many of the plots of those films, even if you haven't seen it, it percolated into the culture enough that I know it. Or it's just sort of like the Bible in the sense that you don't have to have read it.
Well, not if you don't want to go to heaven, John.
Yeah, I know. And as somebody who steadfastly refuses to go to heaven, I
avoid the Bible at all costs.
I will not read it.
But I'm not even going to open that drawer in the hotel because it's going to get me slightly closer to heaven.
I feel like I know the stories, though. You know what I mean? Like, there's hardly any biblical right. reference you can make that it's not clear. Like, oh, yeah, right. And Shakespeare the same. Like, you know this. You know the plots.
The main way Treasure of the Sierra Madre has percolated into the culture is through the Blazing Saddles bit about not needing any stinking badges. Uh-huh. That's a Mexican cop in, or a Mexican bandito type in Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Right.
I think it's often misquoted. He never says, we don't need no stinking badges.
What does he say?
We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
It conflates too. It's like, I am your father, Luke. You know, where they just take the two adjacent lines and everybody misquotes them.
That's how it should be. The scriptwriters should. We should go. They if I went back in time, I wouldn't kill Hitler.
I think
I would make that adjustment.
Yeah,
to
I think
the
we're
script.
Right and they're all wrong. Yeah, if right. if 100,000 people think your line is one way, then it really should be. I am your father, Luke.
Berenstain Bears.
I'm from a parallel universe where Blazing Saddles quoted it right. You know, I don't love Treasure of the Sierra Madre. I watched it on TCM, I don't know, many years ago. I should probably give it another chance because I love Bogart. I love John Huston movies.
Maybe it's past the point where you would watch it as an adventure story and instead watch it as a cultural artifact.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I would say over maybe 2/3 of the reason why I watch old movies is because they are not, relaxing, passive entertainment. Like you're constantly being like, ooh, like look what the butler's wearing,
right.
Or
what is that?
Yeah, exactly. Look at this weird Art Deco set that looks nothing like a real penthouse. Or like, what is that slang term she just used? Or I was watching the. You ever see the Peter Cook Dudley Moore movie Bedazzled?
Yes,
where he sells his soul and keeps trying to make wishes, and Satan keeps tricking him.
Yeah,
I mean it's just an insane late '60s artifact where Dudley Moore wrote this kind of music score, and Raquel Welch does a sexy dance, and you're like, this is from another planet. Yeah. And if you sat down thinking this is going to be a fun comedy like the Brendan Fraser remake, you're going to be pissed off. But like, it's way more fun that it's such a curio, you know, that people are not acting like people.
You can almost mute them if you're not really into mid-Atlantic accents. In bringing up Baby, there were scenes where they had an actual leopard that was interacting with them.
Baby, the titular baby.
The titular baby. But there were also lots of rear projection shots where the leopard's in the car with them or whatever, but it's clearly not real. And halfway through the movie, I was more fascinated by what is the decision making here, where sometimes it's a leopard, sometimes it's a rear projection leopard, and sometimes it's a split screen, or you know, they film the leopard in the room and then they film the people in the room and kind of superimpose them.
That's the barrier to modern people, is any moment where you're reminded it's a movie, you know, because I think a lot of people just want 2 hours of blankness, you know, 2 hours of not thinking. That's the gift that movies give them.
Yeah.
But I'm with you. I'm, you know, when I see a bad special effect, I'm like, yay, you know?
In particular, set dressing, where you see things that a contemporary filmmaker trying to make the house look like it's in the 30s would never have actually made it look like a
25-foot ceiling. And
yeah, or like the weird choice of just like colonial furniture. You know, a contemporary set dresser would do that Great Gatsby thing where they're like, everything is going to be exactly Gatsby, and not realize that, you know, Gatsby had some old stuff. You know, Gatsby yeah. bought some stuff at a thrift store too, or there was some stuff in the house when he bought it already, you know? And that stuff is fun to see when you look at old movies. Well, like,
by the way, Gatsby goes in the public domain January 1st. So you can make your movie of Gatsby with all the right furniture.
Really? Can I make a musical? Can I make it a musical?
You can,
a hip hop musical.
Gatsby. Didn't Baz Luhrmann already do that?
Yes, he did.
I mean, that also kind of brings up that the pace of these movies is what's kind of yeah. difficult to people. Cause you know, often it just not even the things that happen in the screenplay, but it's the fact that, you know, it'll be like a 2-minute master shot will be the scene, and we're not used to that.
Yeah, the shots where they what was the movie I watched just recently? Some World War II era spy movie where a guy walked up 3 flights of stairs and the camera, it didn't follow him. The camera just planted itself at the top of the stairs and waited for him.
That's nice. That's thoughtful.
So we spent real time waiting for him to walk. We could hear him walking up the stairs. And it wasn't even for dramatic purposes. It was just like, we got to wait for him. He's coming.
Treasure of the Sierra Madre is kind of ahead of the rear projection leopard curve because it was one of the first big Hollywood movies to actually shoot on location.
Oh.
Which was held to be incredibly impractical and expensive in the 30s and 40s. But
so this is post-war.
Yeah, 1948. And it was shot around 46, 47. John Huston actually went to Mexico and shot big chunks of this movie. You know, which is about the corrupting influence of this hidden cache of gold on a couple ne'er-do-well treasure hunters from north of the border.
No honor among thieves.
Bogart and Tim Holt. And John Huston cast his own dad as the kind of crazy old guy who's prospector guy who's gone native. And he won an Oscar. It won 3 Oscars. It was one of the biggest box office hits of 1948. The studio wasn't wrong. It was incredibly expensive and went wildly over budget to shoot this movie in Mexico. But John Huston was kind of always, I was always my own man. I'm now Peter Bogdanovich, and I do very accurate impressions of directors no one's heard of. But while Huston was shooting in Mexico, the set received a visit from a man named Hal Croves, who claimed to be the literary agent of B. Traven, the mysterious reclusive author now living in Mexico who had written Treasure of the Sierra Madre in the previous decade.
And B is the first initial B.
B initial, Traven. Yeah.
And B for Bernard or
And it stands for nothing
Boris.
In the books. You know, the books just say... there's no about the author. It just says B. Traven, Tamaulipas, Mexico or something. You know, that's all you get because this guy was the most reclusive author of his time. And really, I mean, a better recluse than Salinger or Pynchon for sure, because nobody knows where he came from. Like nobody thinks Salinger is an alien.
Right. Who just bailed.
Who just showed up in small town New Hampshire or whatever. Like he was a guy with friends or whatever who just decided he would not be in the papers anymore. And, you know, I don't understand that. We don't have that anymore, but sure.
But B. Traven is like the guy that
came out of nowhere.
He's like the guy that invented Bitcoin. Nobody knows anything about it.
Let's get on the dark web and find B. Traven. His own publishers never met him. There's even disagreement over which language his books were originally written in. There were some claims that they were German books later translated into English, but American audiences were often told they were English books that had later been translated into German. And in fact, readers have noticed that the language is awkward in both languages. Like the German versions of his book appear to have weird Americanisms in them, you know, mistranslated slang and so forth. Whereas the American versions of his book also sound like an ESL speaker. You know, you can almost hear the thick German accent on the page sometimes.
There's a whole discipline of literary archaeology that where those people also have not read the Bible but pretend to have. surely someone has done a deep dive on Treasure of Sierra Madre to find out the Ur-text.
Many, many people have. They're called Travenologists.
Oh, wow.
You can, yeah, this is an exact specific study of, you know, not paranormal investigation, but, you know, unsolved mysteries type.
Is there a sense that the book was created by extraterrestrials, for instance, or chupacabras?
I mean, that would explain why it's weird in both German and English, right? If it's originally written in Venusian.
Right.
So because of the mass number of amateur and professional literary scholars trying to get to the bottom of Traven's mystery, both in his lifetime and after, there's nothing but theories. He is variously American, British, Swedish, Norwegian, Lithuanian, or German. There's very kind of outlandish, fanciful theories where he is a famous author like Jack London or Ambrose Bierce, who has disappeared into Mexico, faking his own death in some cases in order to continue writing. I don't know if the numbers...
because there's nothing beats writing, you know? Like
I'm going to go off the grid and write...
The fame and the money.
Social novels.
That's not what you want to do. You just want to be left alone.
I love the Jack London theory. I didn't think about this. When was Jack London born? Jack London was born in 1876. Well, it's not impossible. Traven died in 1969. So Jack London would have been 95 years old and this his second life.
Right.
So I guess the dates work out. But it's the kind of thing where the outlandish theories get all the ink. So in one account, he is actually Mexican President Adolfo López Mateos. And this is not totally crazy because his sister, President Mateos's sister, before he was in office, Esperanza, did in fact discover Traven's work and translate it into Spanish and get him a huge Mexican following.
Huh.
President Mateos, you know, spent the rest of his life denying that he was in fact B. Traven. Even his own widow often wondered if he was an illegitimate son of Kaiser Wilhelm II, because he had a weird little shrine full of clippings about Kaiser Wilhelm, which you would not expect one of the leading social realist, anarcho-syndicalist authors of his day
right.
to have.
Unless
he really was a lost prince. Or in another variety, he's the lost half-brother of Walter Rathenau, a Weimar era German official, like a pretty important one. I think foreign minister of Weimar Germany, you know, could he have been the illegitimate offspring of either Kaiser Wilhelm's father or Kaiser Wilhelm II with some stage actress
right.
or the father of minister Walter Rathenau. So he, you know, there's lots of theories where he's a celebrity. And at one point Life magazine was reported to have offered a $5,000 reward for information leading to the, intellectual capture of B. Traven, although that's probably just a rumor started in the Mexican press to gin up interest in his work.
Did anybody ever suggest that it might be Sir Francis Bacon?
Sir Francis
Christopher
Bacon.
Christopher Marlowe?
Now 650 years old.
So this was a mystery even in its time and one that was in the newspapers.
In 1946, as Houston is shooting Sierra Madre in Mexico, this Hal Croves guy... tight-lipped Hal Croves guy who keeps showing up on set saying that he's Traven's agent and watching everything. It becomes just common knowledge among the crew that this is in fact Traven.
Oh.
And Houston in fact didn't believe it. And to the end of his life in his memoirs always said, I was never sure that guy was Traven, but that immediately became common knowledge on the crew that Traven was hanging out here undercover as his own agent. And, you know, when the movie came out and was a big hit, suddenly the spotlight turned to him, both in America and in Mexico and stateside.
He interfering in the production? Was he, like, monkeying with the script, his agent?
He would be like, in my book, the book of my client, B. Traven. No, apparently he just kept his head down. He was exactly the way you would expect a reclusive author to act on the set, which maybe was the problem. But
he was just there for free craft services.
That's right. He's always hanging around crafty, eating all the good breakfast burritos as soon as they come up.
But can't you forensically just figure out where the money is going?
Well, that's what happened. So after the movie came out, suddenly this guy is now So he had written a series of novels. You know, throughout his career, he wrote 12 social novels and a series of short stories, mostly about Mexico and mostly about the oppressed people of Mexico, peasants, Indians, underpaid oil workers, you know, the kind of the common man and you know, upholding their dignity against
these are the Steinbeck of Mexico.
Yeah, against the forces that are laying them low. And, you know, there were certainly a ton of 20th century writers that discovered Mexico as this amazing kind of quasi-lawless canvas where anything could happen. So D.H. Lawrence and Malcolm Lowry and Graham Greene, you know, all write novels about, you know, kind of the adventures that one can still have in Mexico. Right. But Mexico loved Treven in a way that they did not take to all these other authors. He got it right. You know, for one thing, he was the one that stayed. You know, Lawrence may have lived on the beach for 3 years and written The Plumed Serpent and then headed to Australia or whatever. But Treven stayed. And
the books were...
They seemed authentic.
They were clearly not written in Spanish, in other words.
Right. And, you know, he never claimed... And the books start... His books start out in Germany. His first book is called... It's usually translated as The Cotton Pickers, but I think in German it's Der Wobbly.
Oh.
As in the international workers of the world. Yeah. About low-paid farmhands. And his second book, if you're plotting his journeys across the world, is called The Ghost Ship. Or sorry, The Death Ship. I think it's usually translated as The Death Ship. And it's about a coffin ship. Are you aware of this phrase? I had not heard of a coffin ship.
This seems like an omnibus episode.
Maybe we should do coffin ships.
What is a coffin? Maybe I should do one now.
It is not. You have access. It is not a ship full of coffins. It's a ship that has been overinsured such that it's worth more dead than alive. It's worth more sunk than alive back in London or Hamburg or wherever.
Right.
Which means that it's an incredibly unsafe place to work because nobody cares. You know, it's the lowest level of safety, the lowest paid people, the scum of the earth walking its planks.
Right. Please start an oil fire. Please.
Whatever you do, please crash into that reef off the coast of Senegal. We would love it. Wink, wink. No survivors would be better. Anyway, so his second book is about the kind of the low lives aboard this kind of ship. And then after that, the books are all set in Mexico, in the jungles.
And these books originally appeared in German, giving credence to the idea that he's...
The first two originally appeared in German. At some point in his Mexican career, they started to come out in English and German simultaneously, or even in North America first. And Mexico, his last book is in 1960, he wrote a novel called Aslan Noval, which has never even been translated into English.
The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
Yeah, it's an unfinished eighth Narnia book.
Fanfic?
You walk through a closet and suddenly you're in Chiapas and they're shooting at you. And so, you know, and this is kind of an off the rails. Many scholars have said it must be by a different hand because it's this weird kind of torrid, quasi-pornographic, you know, a real kind of potboiler.
Well, he was 90 by that time.
Well,
so.
If he's Jack London, he's he's almost 90. If he's these other guys, maybe he's closer to 80. And so, you know, he has this weird career arc where, you know, despite producing one of the best known novels of the 20th century, thanks to Humphrey Bogart and John Huston, a lot of his work is this weird anarchist, Marxist-Leninist social novels.
And polemical.
Polemical, extremely polemical. And not all that well written. Like, by all accounts, just not a great stylist, but an amazing flair for narrative. So that you're and the authenticity. You know, some of it's just the local color of really knowing this weird milieu of the poverty of the Mexican jungles well, but also apparently just a real page turners. Somerset Maugham once called himself, you know, the first tier of the second tier writers. And you could say the same thing about Treven, I think. Mexico loved him once his works were in translation there. When he died, his ashes were spread from a plane over southern Mexico, and a village in Chiapas near where the ashes had been deposited actually changed its name, you know, adding De Treven to the end of its name.
Because his ashes showed up in their coffee one morning.
Yeah, exactly.
They were like, "What is
boy?" There's a little bit of Treven in all of us now, isn't there? But as you pointed out, you can't write the source novel for one of the biggest movies of 1948 without having Life and Look magazine come looking for you, and that's exactly what happened. A Mexican journalist named Luis Spota. At one point here, there's a war between two Mexican newspapers called Hoy and Mañana, Today and Tomorrow, that are fighting over this. And it seems like Hoy is always getting in the last word, which is very odd.
Right.
Considering that Mañana should have the next day's news.
You would think, but you know, there's a war between Hoy and
Mañana in the mind of every Mexican.
There's a war between hoy and mañana in my own mind, and hoy always gets the last word there too.
I would say that's true. Well, I don't know. Does that mean you always do things today and not tomorrow?
No, but tomorrow, John really has to suck it.
Yeah,
right. Today, John is not making any decisions on his behalf,
which is a bummer.
It's
because you're less than 12 hours away from becoming him.
It's especially a bummer when I regard past John and think about all of his crimes.
How he screwed you over.
He screwed me over time and time again.
Well, that's good. You need to pay it forward.
That's right.
The future John.
Why should future John benefit? I'm not benefiting.
I'm not him.
Yeah.
Yet.
Screw that guy. Ken, we've been trying to get omnibus merch to the Futurelings for a long time. And, you know,
we just weren't trying that hard.
Yeah. Doing a great show two times a week has been our main focus. And neither of us have a especially mercantile mentality, but demand was so high that we've come up with a pretty great way of getting shirts to our fans.
If you go to omnibusproject.com/store right now, there are a variety of shirts as well as hoodies, stickers, magnets, mugs, and more stuff coming now. Every month, we now have two shirts from our friend Dave at Mediocrity. November shirts were kind of a fun Tintin-like cartoon of us and a cool omnibus seal. I think you're also going to like December shirts if you like mail trucks, folks.
Hello.
And or airplanes. And then via TeePublic, there's a wider variety of stuff that just says omnibus or Futurelings. And boy, what a great holiday shopping idea, John.
Well, that's the thing. It's the holiday season for a large variety of the holiday merrymakers of the world, including pagans. And
it's their solstice, too.
That's right.
Before we stole it.
The druids, like, who knows who they are or where they're from. But it's a great time to buy them a gift of omnibus merch. This is a good way to convert your friends and family to listening to omnibus. Get them a hoodie. And then they learn to love it, and then they start listening to the show.
It's the holiday season, so hoop-de-doo and dickery-dock, and don't forget to hang up your sock.
Sure, hoop-de-doo, the famous holiday saying.
Because we all say hoop-de-doo and dickery-dock this time of year, and just exactly at 12 o'clock, he'll be coming down the chimney with omnibus gifts for the whole family. This stuff looks good.
We're excited to offer this to you, and we hope that that your pent-up demand has not run out and dissipated, but that the pressure has continued to build, and now you can release it by buying multiple sizes and designs.
And then after a short refractory period, place a new order.
Yeah, that's right. January's t-shirts will be just as cool.
The shirts are always limited time. So if you like one of the Mediocrity designs, do not delay because they will be replaced by two new designs at the start of every month. Omnibusproject.com/store for details.
Omnibusproject.com/store.
These journalists started tracking down this supposed Hal Croves. So they follow him to, I think, Acapulco, where he's kind of a innkeeper living in anonymity. And they spy on him. And in fact, this Luis Spota guy starts opening his mail.
Oh!
Because it's Mexico.
Oh, these are the old days.
Mexico of the late 40s. You can just...
Sure.
And finds that...
he's carrying on a torrid correspondence with Eleanor Roosevelt.
With Kaiser Wilhelm II. Where he calls him daddy, but not in that way. No, he finds that the guy who was saying he was Hal Croves is actually living in Acapulco as Traven Torsvan.
Okay.
An American immigrant who came down to work in the cotton fields and later kind of lucked into a job taking photographs for archaeological expeditions. This is a big trope in all these expat Mexican novels, there's always American college students tromping through the woods. So I assume that was actually happening.
Sure.
Looking for ruins and whatnot. And so he was the photographer. And there's a surviving photo of this Torsvan character in one of these expeditions. And he looks exactly how you want him to, with a big pith helmet. And then doing a series of odd jobs from exterminator to I don't know, bookbinder.
So the
on the Mexican coast.
So the agent now is... also living a false identity.
Hal Croves appears to be Traven Torsvan. And Traven later, Torsvan later married At a Yasha Heifetz concert in Mexico City, he met a Mexican woman named Rosa Elena Luján and married her. So he was married to a Mexican woman for many years. And when he finally died in the late 60s, she announced that, you know, now it can be told. And B. Traven was actually Traven Torzvon, a.k.a. Hal Croves, a Chicago-born American in Mexico, the product of a Norwegian-American father and, you know, Anglo-Saxon, just a regular, boring old Scotch-English mother who came to Mexico and stayed.
Did he kill Trotsky?
He probably killed Trotsky. And she, at the end of the conference, she was like, and he probably killed Trotsky. No questions.
So if that's the case, then why is this a mystery still?
Well, so we now have two possible identities for B. Traven, Hal Croves and Traven Torzvon. Somewhat later in life, sometime between 1969 and what, this 1990 New York Times article I'm reading, an interview with Rosa Elena Luján, she announced that in fact, and she lived until 2009. In our time, you know, that's the distant past to our listeners, but
right.
You know, she was alive
11 years ago.
Yeah, she was alive when I was already a has-been. And to the end of her life in 2009, she actually claimed that although he wouldn't let me talk about this while he was alive, he said, only after I'm dead can you let this be known, that Hal Croves, before he was Traven Torzvon, before they were both B. Traven, was also Rhett Marut,
oh,
a Bavarian actor turned revolutionary, who had actually been part of this cabal that had briefly, in 1919, turned his part of Bavaria into a Soviet-style republic before the Weimar police came in and shut down the Reds.
So Rhett Marut reinvented himself as the son of a Norwegian diplomat.
Yes, apparently one of the reasons to pretend you're American at this time is because you could say you were from San Francisco. Do you know why you would want to say you were from San Francisco in the 1920s?
Because yeah, the presumption would be you're a good dancer.
Yes. I mean, that's one of the fringe benefits.
Uh-huh.
No, the records had all been lost
in the fire
and earthquake.
Oh, so you could be,
you could be anybody.
You could falsify your birth certificate and claim you were.
Yeah. I was born in 1889 in San Francisco and nobody could say boo, basically. Oh. They would happily give you rice-a-roni and send you on your way.
Oh, that's kind of brilliant.
It's too late now. You can't do it.
Mm.
Is there some place you could say you're from today where, you know, it's such a disaster that...
You know, my arrest record, I wish there was a way to do an omnibus show on this, because courthouse fires persisted until modern times as a thing where everything was lost. And there was a courthouse fire in Boulder, Colorado, where my arrest and imprisonment records, mugshots, police reports from my time in jail there, all disappeared in a puff of smoke and no one can find them. And
you were so smart to do these crimes before computers.
Right? There's as far as I can tell, there's no record of it except for the one time I admitted to it at the Canadian border and got turned away.
Back then there was one crime solving computer and Batman had it.
Beep, 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 beep.
And a little piece of paper would come out and say, John Roderick is the Joker.
So I'm stunned that you could still lose all the records of a whole county.
Do you think this rash of courthouse fires is because of people like you who know that they can get expunged if they set fire to a courthouse? I mean, I'm not saying you lit the Boulder courthouse on fire, but did you?
No, right? I think that what it is there were a lot of cows that were housed in courthouse basements.
Cows,
and they still used oil lamps, and cows were constantly knocking over oil lamps.
And then farting methane all over them.
Yeah, and the conflagration would burn the whole town down, or at least the courthouse.
I think Mrs. O'Leary's cow never kicked anything. It's just you couldn't say in the papers it farted cow farts all over the oil lamp, igniting the barn.
Is the methane concentrated enough in a cow fart that all you have to do is just fart on a lamp?
I'm from the Reagan era. You remember how Reagan always used to say that cows were causing global
right.
warming and right. greenhouse
ketchup
gases?
Ketchup was a vegetable, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, those two things.
No matter
what the press asked him about around Contra, he would say, well, ketchup is a vegetable and greenhouse gases. Why is he Carson?
yeah.
The So you could claim San Francisco, much as you can claim to be a good upstanding citizen in Boulder.
That's genius. Did you ever try to get a fake ID? I actually got my hands on a stack of blank baptismal certificates.
Is this a way to get a fake ID?
It used to be.
You didn't need a civil document?
You could claim that your birth certificate was lost or that you'd never been issued one, but you could present a baptismal certificate and some other supporting evidence. This was back when the driver's license was just a laminated piece of cardboard.
You and I both had old bad tech driver's license.
Yeah, where if the license got wet, it would come delaminated right. And the picture would fall out. Yeah. I was like, no, this is my license, sorry. But I took this baptismal certificate and I weathered it in that way that you used to do. You dip it in coffee and then, you know, kind of, I went overboard and kind of burned the edges so it looked like a treasure map.
For a Mormon, falsifying documents is less bad than actually buying the coffee. So this is unavailable to me.
And I had all the documentation and I was going to go down and, you know, like gird my loins and go in and present all this documentation at the DMV to get a fake ID. And then I took a trip to New York and, this was old Times Square when it was full of,
porn
and bad people. And there was a little kiosk that was like IDs. And
like now it's off-brand Elmo, but like that guy was running an ID kiosk.
I was like, IDs? It was like a shop. And I went in and was like, I'd like an ID. And he's, you know, kind of pulled his green visor down and sat, you know, pulled up to his typewriter. And he was like, all right, name. And I was like, John Roderick. And he was like, date of birth. And I just gave him some date of birth.
This is even in movies, you have to go find the guy in the dimly lit back of the antique shop.
No, he was just like... And he did this incredible thing, which was I said my birthday. I gave him my birthday, but with a
different year.
A different year. You know, I was like September, and my birthday is not September 4th. I'm just using that as an example. I was like September 4th, you know, 1964.
I like that you don't want people to know your real birthday.
It's on the internet if you want to know my real birthday.
Don't send him a present.
It was just a couple of days ago. And he typed it out, September 4th. Like, and so the birthday line is an entire line of this.
On a real ID, it would just be numbers, right?
Just numbers. And he put some like fake ID number, you know, like 7211174. And he put it through his laminator and it was like $15. And I brought that thing back with me to the West. And it worked 8 out of 10 times.
Because it's out of state.
Yeah, it was just like some New York ID.
Yeah.
The guy at the Quickie Mart was like, okay, I guess you're 24.
How old were you in this actual store?
17.
Wait, is the ID store still there?
I don't know. I think you're right. It is an Elmo store. No, it's that tickets kiosk now.
Yeah, I bought really cheap tickets to the play where everything goes wrong there.
You could have gotten a fake ID if you'd been there in the 80s.
If you just whisper to the guy, I bet he'd still do it. So it's not uncommon for people to use San Francisco as a place of origin. And, you know, a lot of people coming from Europe to Mexico almost certainly did so via North America anyway. So that's the border they would have crossed. But Rhett Marut,
who's like a
dangerous dissident.
Rhett Marut is a person there's records.
There
for.
Is record of, but the records disappear in 19. Oh, sorry. The records disappear around, you know, the 20s, whenever he would have showed up in London and got his way out of Europe. Mm-hmm. The story that later got told was he was actually arrested for his part in this armed uprising and put into a truck handcuffed to some other guy. But either with, you know, the door was left open, possibly with the complicity of the driver or whatever. So while the truck's in motion, he and the other guy jump out, handcuffed together, like Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier or whatever. And the other guy died on impact. And so he had to escape with a dead guy on his arm. And I guess for the rest of his life, he did have a scar. The real Traven did, or, you know, the Traven who lived until 1969 in Mexico had a scar on his wrist. That bore out this story of a dramatic escape from Germany.
And maybe that guy was actually Rhett Marut and our hero took his identity.
Yeah, it's a Don Draper scenario.
It was the other guy. It was me that died, and now I'm Rhett Maroot.
So the mystery appeared to be solved because, you know, his widow was interviewed many times. She, you know, scholars came, travenologists came over and got to go through his papers. They got to see samples of Maroot's handwriting. They got to see that in the first page of, what's he called? Traven Torzvon's Mexican Journal, he said something like, "The Bavarian from Munich is dead forever." So, you know, a pretty clear indication that he was not from Chicago.
Although he could have been talking about the guy, the dead guy that's still handcuffed
to
him.
That's the guy on his wrist. Yeah. Yeah. His wife never noticed that he always just had a cloth over one shoulder. It's just a tumor, honey. But the problem with this Rhett Maroot story, so we now know that B. Traven was alias Hal Croves, alias, which was an alias of Traven Torzvon, which was an alias of Rhett Maroot. The problem with the Rhett Maroot story is it appears that Rhett Maroot kind of appeared in 1907.
I don't think of that as a Bavarian name either, Rhett Maroot.
Yeah, what's going on there?
I don't know. It sounds Hungarian to me.
We would like to hear from some Central European listeners explaining to us, could a Bavarian in the 1920s really have been named Rhett Maroot?
But Rhett Maroot appears out
of... Rhett Maroot's a Star Wars character, honestly.
You're right.
Bounty hunter Rhett Maroot. He appears in 1907...
Fully formed.
Out of nowhere, right? Okay.
All right.
Which is nice, because now we already have four identities for this guy, but there's still work for the travenologists.
Is he Kaiser Sose?
He's Kaiser Wilhelm. We've talked about this. In 1980, a BBC producer working on a special about the Traven mystery... digs even deeper than ever before, trying to figure out if this guy was Rhett Maroot, as even his widow later admitted, although she only became clear on this apparently sometime in the 70s.
I love that the implication of this is that all of the people that looked into this before dug down to a certain depth and then threw their shovels to the ground.
They got enough for their article and were like, I did it. That's very relatable to me.
This intrepid BBC producer is like, wait a minute, what's my... My shovel is hitting something hard.
Well, the thing about each new author is you have to come up with something to beat the old guy. Right. You know, like that guy got just enough to publish, and which is very relatable to me as an author. Mm-hmm. Like, well, it doesn't matter if the work's thorough as long as it's plausible.
as long as it's done.
as long as the publisher has it and will get off my back. So this BBC producer spent a long time trying to track down you know, who this Rhett Maroot guy was. And there were plenty of clues in London, it turned out. That was where he first sought asylum from Germany after his escape. And apparently all paths led... He finally got... after a lot of dead ends, he finally heard from a Polish city in what was then East Prussia, today Poland, with confirmation of the existence of a guy named Otto Fiege. Just a regular guy, a clocksmith's apprentice, born in what is now Poland in the 1890s. Otto Fiege. And he was interested in, and Otto Fiege's mother's maiden name was Wienicke. And this is what rang alarm bells for our BBC producer because...
These are all Star Wars characters.
Because Fiege and Wienicke were two of the aliases that... that Rhett Maroot gave the British authorities when he was seeking asylum there.
Gave them as references or gave them as...
Former aliases.
Oh, former aliases.
Yeah, back home I was sometimes Fiege. I'm Rhett Maroot, but I was sometimes Fiege, sometimes Wienicke. So the discovery of this Otto Fiege, and Otto Fiege luckily had there's plenty of evidence in his favor. His birthday was just 2 days away from the birthday that Rhett Maroot had later claimed.
Uh-huh.
So he's kind of like you.
Yeah, like me in Times Square. September 5th.
That'll get him off my tracks. There's also the fact that, you know, Fiege, the names match Fiege and Wienicke. But also, Otto Fiege had a brother and a sister still living in West Germany. And so this producer was able to visit them, and they could produce... photographs of the young Otto Fiege and handwriting of the young Otto Fiege. The handwriting is a little bit contested, you know, even in courtrooms today, that still happens.
Right.
So travenologists can believe the handwriting or not. But to me, the photographic, you know, if not for the birthday and the fact that the names Fiege and Wienicke both check out, the fact that the photographs, according to his living siblings, matched the earliest known photos of
Otto Fige.
Well, no, they were Otto Fige, but they matched the photographs of Rhett Marut turned Travan Torsvan turned Hal Croves turned B. Traven.
Have you seen these photos?
I have not seen the child photos. And to this day, there are still, you know, if you read the Wikipedia entry on B. Traven, it will talk about how the Otto Fige, I think I've been saying Fige, and it's actually Otto Fige. They will say that the Otto Fige theory is really not held in much regard.
Why would we stop here? Why would Travenologists?
I think that's the problem.
Not go the whole way.
I think that's the problem. You don't want the mystery to be solved if this is your hobby.
I see.
Oh no, I can. I'm looking right here at. Here's some photos of Rhett Marut after he showed up in London in kind of an unfortunately Hitlerian mustache and a flat newsboy cap. And here's Otto Fige from Germany. I don't know. It's not bad. I would say the high eyes and the low nose are particularly convincing. I would say I am very convinced.
Can you send them over to me? Can I look at them here and on my side of the bunker?
It's a little difficult because the Fige picture's in profile.
He's in profile, but he does have a very long nose.
Yeah, look at the way the nose starts flat at the bridge.
Yeah. He does have many of the characteristics of his later self. Rhett Marut, then there's Torvan, and then there's Croves. I feel like the latter three are definitely the same man. Yes, I'm going to say they're all the same.
No further questions, Your Honor.
And I believe their handwriting is the same, even if there's evidence to the contrary.
You're now an expert Travenologist. No, I was also fairly convinced by the Otto Fige case, and it seems to me that people disputing it are just, you know, they don't want the fun to be over.
Right.
There's, you know, a solved mystery. There's no TV show called Solved Mysteries.
But I don't feel that it is solved by discovering that he is just some rando from Brandenburg.
We have everything about his life in his five identities. I mean, we now have a pretty good paper trail. You can see how this small town East Prussian, you know, got into left-wing literature, became an actor and a journalist, went to the big city, you know, went to Munich, fell in with the Reds, started a revolution, got out just ahead of the cops, seeks asylum in London, gets to Mexico, possibly via the US border, has a series of odd jobs, and then, you know, based on his journalistic past and, you know, continues his novels. Yeah.
How old was he when his first novel was published?
If he was born in 1882, then his first book came out from a Berlin-based house in 1926. So he already would have been in his 40s. And in fact, he already would have been out of Germany. So it looks like he would have, you know, maybe he had his sense of the publishing scene still would have led him to contact back in Germany, even though he had already fled.
So the possibilities here are that he is changing his identity repeatedly to escape a dastardly past, either because he's being pursued by Interpol because he's a revolutionary.
Or Interpol, the inner demons of...
Right, Interpol.
Like maybe he just doesn't want to think about the past and the violence and the failures.
Or he's like a Jack the Ripper who keeps killing and then changing his identity and moving on.
Oh, you think he's got a reason for all these new identities? Like,
well, the only other reason is that he's a total nut and that this is what he thinks is fun. But there's no evidence that anyone is having fun with this other than him, right? I mean, he.
Well, there seem to be, like, as I think about it, the reason for the Rhett Marut identity could be that now he's in the big city starting a new career as an actor.
Right.
That's a time when you
might... Stage name.
Yeah, stage name, journalistic pen name. The reason to change that name once he flees Germany and flees Europe is obvious. That's why you want to pretend to be Travan Torsvan, a of good American stock.
But why would he reveal his aliases at the to London authorities? If you're like,
right,
if you're like, I'm Tarsvold Torvain, why the heck would you say, but also AKA Rhett Marut, AKA Otto Friesbald?
Is it, an abundance of, out of an abundance of effort to seem to be cooperative in hopes of getting the asylum,
yeah.
Now you feel like you're safe. The guy interviews you for an hour and you tell him the whole sordid story, maybe leaving out the communism because you want asylum. He jots down the, he puts Feige and Wieneke in your file.
It's bad tradecraft if you're truly into being sneaky.
This is not, he was never trying to construct a life, He was always just kind of staying one step ahead and just trying to lay low in a time when you actually could. Today, as we were saying, courthouses don't burn down anymore. The data is all in a cloud.
Right.
And it's really not possible to live this sort of life anymore, to disappear into the bushes, really. I mean, anybody who wants to follow you probably still can, right? Is that a net good for society?
The one thing I've never understood is, if you want to disappear into Mexico and live the quiet life, you absolutely can. Just don't write multiple novels, right? Like, what to write a novel, I guess, to make art and put it out there and have it consumed by others is a need separate from the need to be lauded and noticed and celebrated and
think about all these stories you hear about stars or writers who like have alt accounts online and social media pseudonyms and stuff so they can get in there and argue about their own work, like even if people don't know it's them, they really want to get in and mix it up about their art with the reader or viewer or listener,
I was thinking
they get caught sometimes, and that's when it's funny.
I was thinking of it in the other way, which is that, like, I discovered the other day that Kelly Deal,
Kim Deal's twin sister from the Breeders,
yes,
who passed away, right?
No, Kelly Deal is still alive, and in fact has a side gig where she knits scarves, and sells them. And so, although she is, probably occupied a certain amount of her day being Kelly Deal, guitarist of the Breeders, and just cool recovering junkie chick from Massachusetts, she also is like...
Is she big in the scarf community?
Well, she's actively knitting and selling scarves and other knit garments. And I reached out to her because I liked her work, but the idea of it was so fascinating to me. She's not really trying to sell her scarves on the strength of her guitar playing, right? She's not, she's not actively like buy Kelly Deal's old t-shirts or whatever. She's just knitting scarves. And if you research her deeply enough, you find that she's not hiding it, but it's just something that's not limelight based activity at all. And
they might enjoy the break. They might enjoy the possibility for their new work to be enjoyed on its own merits. They might just,
she's not
think it's unseemly to lead with your.
Yeah,
but irrelevancies about your past life.
But she didn't call herself Emilio Estevez either, right? She's not disavowing herself or her heritage.
In my own community, I know a woman named Jackie Fuchs who was a Jeopardy multi-day champ. Won enough money, I think, to make it into a tournament of champions or be on the cusp of one. And it wasn't until like her fourth show where Alex said, "Aren't you? Tell us about your music career." And then it turned out she was Jackie Fox. Bassist for the Runaways.
Really?
Yeah. And she'd already like won 3 Jeopardies and kind of become a social media sensation before everyone's like, wait, what? She was in Joan Jett's band?
Wow.
And I think it was exactly for that reason. Like, she wanted to be, appreciated on the basis of her Jeopardy chops.
Right.
And not the past. But
But as someone whose desire to create, whose career has happened in a time when that all was predicated on being somewhat in the public eye and desiring to be like it, desiring it in the sense that there was no other option for your music to be a success, for it to be consumed
without being a public
figure, being a public figure,
profiles written about you and people knowing where you live.
Yeah. All the rock stars that you knew, at least in Seattle, who tried to, you know, wear a Mexican wrestler mask or be like Sunny Day Real Estate and not do interviews. Those were all unsuccessful attempts to keep privacy or to keep anonymity, right? They weren't successful at the level at the level of actually protecting their anonymity, but also not creatively successful.
The Mystique thing works occasionally, like with, you know, the early Bell and Sebastian records or something.
Right. Question mark and the Mysterians.
Question mark and the Mysterians. Exactly where it's kind of the gimmick of the band is who are these people actually? And I wonder if that ended up working out in Traven's favor when all these magazine profiles were written about him as a mystery man. Maybe he enjoyed that. Maybe he was tormented about his past, or maybe he liked that that he was a blank slate. That, well, people are talking about me, I guess. Some are right and some are wrong, but for a lot of people, that's the dream.
He wanted to be there on the set to watch the movie being made. I mean, I find that incredibly charming in a way.
Wouldn't you?
As long as he's not changing his identity for sinister reasons. Otherwise, I mean, if he's not, then it's just a weird quirk that is, I don't know, like really endearing.
Yeah, I guess at that, in the 50s, he could have come out and been like, yeah, look, I escaped Germany in the 20s. Like, there's no reason for him not to.
Right.
But either he, you know, he likes the mystique. He thinks he's doing it as a smart career move, or I think more likely there's something inside him, whatever those demons are, that, you know, he's just like us and he wants to see Humphrey Bogart do his novel. But he also kind of wants to be left alone and leave the past in the past.
If you want to be left alone, your alias should be something like Kevin Smith.
Are you saying that director Kevin Smith is actually,
Is actually Jack London?
It's actually Jack the Ripper? It's not impossible.
And that concludes B. Traven, entry 1332.PR2502, certificate number 39453 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that you are B. Traven...
Are you all B. Traven?
Reveal yourselves.
They might have better knowledge about B. Traven. You know, all this stuff, all these new discoveries happened in the 60s, 70s, 80s. You know, maybe there's new Travenologists in the future who actually can plot air molecules backwards and see where he was actually standing when.
B. Traven might have been a sentient aspen the entire time.
Time traveler?
His work is just being generated by like mold spores.
I mean, an argument against time travel is that people do not come out of the woodwork with no paper trail anymore. So when somebody does, like this guy, so we can assume that either time travelers are keeping their heads down,
right,
and not sharing the secrets of the future, or, you know, taking advantage of them to win sports bets or buy stock or whatever.
But how do you account for that picture from 1910 of the guy with the cell phone in Times Square?
Yeah, like it looks like he's wearing a Smith's Meet Is Murder t-shirt. But it's just an optical illusion. He's actually not a time traveler. But maybe B. Traven was. If you are listening in the future, it's time to come back to 1930s Mexico. They need you.
I want to go to 1930s Mexico just so I can be the one that kills Trotsky.
You just want...
I would have done a better job.
You just want cheap tacos at the cantina. Stayed dead.
Anyway...
He would have stayed dead. He did stay dead. Would you have a theory about Trotsky?
B. Traven is Trotsky.
Oh, he might be Trotsky. What if he accidentally said, "What's your name?" I might be Trav. It's like a Fletch thing.
I encourage you, if you are B. Traven, or even if you're not, to go to Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
I would say especially if you're not.
Look up at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick to see what we're up to, what crazy hijinks we're up to today. Our shows are archived at Omnibus Project. I'm on Instagram, and you can see what I'm up to the minute ripped from the headlines. You can email us, and Ken will almost certainly answer, especially if you are argumentative and send us an email that's chastising us for some dumb thing that only you are mad about.
I don't think I'll be. Oh, you mean I won't argue back?
No. If they're right. Hardly ever argue back.
No.
You can email.
Usually people sending an email are right.
Yes.
Because they've taken the time to look it up. People on social media might be wrong.
Yeah, if you're going to write an email, take the time to be right at least, at the very least. But you can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can go on our Facebook page, which Ken does not check, but I do. This is the paradox of Omnibus social media.
You mean the Futurelings page?
The Futurelings page on social media accounts.
I read it sometimes.
Oh, I guess you do. That's right. You reply to people.
I know you must read it because anytime your reputation is besmirched in any way, suddenly there's three paragraph Jeremiah from you, even though I didn't know you read the page.
That's right. I'm like, how dare you?
You keep an eye on that page.
How dare you?
But only the worst offenses get you to... crack your knuckles and get out the old typewriter.
It's not just me it's not just when they besmirch me. It's when they besmirch you or our integrity in particular.
I appreciate that.
You can mail us actual letters, boxes, dried foods to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. And if the spirit takes you, you can support the show directly by going to patreon.com/omnibusproject and pledging your financial support. And for that, we are exceedingly grateful.
Hold on, I'm still opening the mail.
Also, if you support the show at Patreon, the Omnibus Project at patreon.com. No, patreon.com/omnibusproject. You have access to all of our bonus features. And some of those bonus features include you receiving real paper documents from us and phone calls, Zoom calls with us.
We'll start calling you at weird times of the day or night. We'll call your wife and tell her you have a girlfriend.
Ken can be your lifeline if you're ever on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
We'll start doing like Harpo Marx-esque pranks.
Yep.
We'll come to your house and just cut the plugs off your appliances for no reason.
At the $1,000 level, I will come to your home and cut your tie.
Honking a little bicycle horn. Hey, by the way, I was opening the mail right now, and this is pretty good. It's you mentioned that it was recently your birthday.
Yes.
You got a chocolate cake-themed birthday card.
I like chocolate cake.
From Jessie with a... she knows you like chocolate cake. She sent you an Albertsons/Safeway gift card.
Oh, that's where the best chocolate cake is.
Famously. Now, it doesn't say this. All we know here is that this gift card is between $5 and $250. So you can either buy a lot of chocolate cake or a lot of chocolate cake.
Which Jessie is that from? A Jessie we know?
I don't know. Jessie IE. We can't know her that well because she sent it to...
Oh, to the... She could have just sent it to my house.
Jessie from Gig Harbor.
It is Jessie IE.
Jesse from Gig Harbor.
I hope you treat yourself to a delicious slice of chocolate cake from Safeway. That's wonderful. Thank you, Jesse.
And then Andrew, after we did the show about Ghost Forest, you remember the petrified trees of the Pacific Coast?
Of course.
He actually visited the Neskowin Ghost Forest. He took his family there because we did a podcast about it.
Nice.
Which is a lot of... I mean, I'm glad we didn't do Chernobyl that week. That shows a lot of trust, Andrew.
Yes.
And he did a painting of the Ghost Forest and a gouache painting and sent us these.
This is our painter.
I don't know. Has he sent us work before? I'm not sure Andrew has sent us work before. We have at least two painters.
Let me see that.
But
that's
I think this is work from an up-and-coming new artist named Andrew.
Oh, wait. This is a photo of a painting.
Yes.
So our normal painter actually sends us the original watercolor.
But Andrew painted a big gouache painting for his living room.
That's wonderful. Look at that.
I stayed right there up on the green bluff. You can see it left. And he really did capture it. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew.
We'll put this on the image feed on the Patreon site so some of our subscribers can enjoy your work as well. Listeners, from our vantage point here in the distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We may be as mysterious to you as B. Traven. We hope and pray that no catastrophe will ever come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.